This episode of the Flush Podcast is brought to you by Federal Premium Ammunition and by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting map app. Onyx, know where you stand. Today, we've brought the gang back together for a Flush Roundup, answering listener questions, discussing dogs, guns, ammo, and a few highlights from the field. Most importantly, we're here today to let you know about Flush apparel that is now on sale. All the proceeds are going straight to Pheasants Forever's Call of the Uplands Habitat Mission. Welcome to another episode of the Flush Podcast. I'm Travis Frank. I'm your host. Brandon Morton is our producer. I'm sitting next to Brandon today, and I'm sitting next to the entire cast of our Flush television show for a rare group podcast. This is our second one, guys. Ron Scher is to my right, Bill Shirk to my left, and straight across me, I'm eye to eye with the big kahuna, the CEO of Ron Scher Productions and fellow host of The Flush, Scott Franzen. Gentlemen, I know that you guys have nothing better to do with your time during the middle of a work week, so I appreciate you taking a few minutes today to join this show. And actually, Bill, really just thank you for letting us come out because we are in your...
The outpost.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what do you call this space? It's like an add-on to your garage.
It's the outpost. We've got the fire going. Ron should have Domino's Pizza coming for us soon. Or...
Yes. That's a switcheroo. We've had a little discussion about, since we're the guests of Mr. Bill Shirk, that he would have lunch for us. Apparently that was a false rumor. And
how's the coffee?
Coffee's great. Travis, oh, I didn't know you brought us all here so you can blow smoke at your CEO.
AKA the big kahuna.
Yeah, I found that rather embarrassing.
I've got a one-on-one meeting with him coming up, so I'm trying to get some points here.
If you slipped Travis $20 before the podcast, you might have gotten a little love too, Ron.
Meanwhile, Scott's got the dog sitting in the truck because you can hear all the roosters out behind in the prairie. So
yeah, I wanted to ask you, Bill. So we're West Metro here in Minnesota. We're about 35, 40 miles west of downtown Minneapolis, but you've got a Pheasants Forever sign sitting on one of your posts on the corner of your property here, and there's it appears to be bluestem, a few other native grasses. What's your layout here on your property?
So Katie and I bought this property in 2013. We're just on the north side of Lake Minnetonka, and I cut buckthorn back there. It was an old pasture, and I cut buckthorn for a summer. I wanted the prairie back in, and since 2013, I've been working on it, and diversity is looking pretty good. We've got grasses. We've done burns each spring. This will be the first spring we are not burning because the grass is so good. Now we're going to work on the diversity with the flowers, and yeah, life is good.
What have you learned by planting your own grasses and some of the challenges? Because we've talked about this over the years, and sometimes it didn't take, and what you had to do to...
Pay somebody else to do it.
Fair enough.
No, it's been very difficult, right? Reed canary is a bugger. Canada thistle is a real bugger. And unless you keep on those constantly and you're doing your work with your spraying and the timing is just right, it just is difficult. But now that the natives have taken over, now with just a little bit of TLC, it takes care of itself. And you can see there's grass that's 8 feet high out there. Mm-hmm. And we've got the pheasants, we've got the deer, we've got all the other critters, the blue boxes, bluebird boxes are full. I mean, it works.
So last night, a lightning storm came through and lit part of the neighbor swamp on fire. What goes through your mind when you see that blaze come flying up?
I'm a little bit like my youngest, Bennett John Shirk, who says, well, this is kind of cool.
Right? You can't not watch.
It's very scary. You know, we're out. We have developed out in wild spaces, right? So there are houses out here on the prairie. So last night was a lightning strike. 4 years ago, we had an even bigger fire out there. Fire trucks parked at every house looking after us, thanks to Maple Plain Fire Department. But Nothing. There are buffers, right? We've developed our property so that the house is safe, but we can have the prairie. We can do burns. Life is good.
Yeah. Well, there were birds cackling when we pulled up.
Yeah, Hank and I have volunteered to take care of Bill's pheasant problem after the podcast, so they won't be bothering you anymore.
Bill, I have a rule. I don't hunt my own birds.
Well, that's your rule.
How about your guests?
I'll hunt my guests. Ron, you got 20 seconds. Run.
Ron, welcome back to town. Palm Springs, how did that treat your golf game?
My golf game has been the same for 30 years. That's just on the edge of horrible.
Yeah.
So nothing to report there. And then came back from Palm Springs in 1st of March and then went down to Tanicomo, Missouri, which is right by Branson. Huh. It was my wife's idea to hang out with a lot of the white-haired people down there. And I kid about all the shows down there, and it's like Las Vegas on
steroids.
Theaters and places and how and motel. I couldn't believe it. I hadn't been there for 40 years. Anyway, we saw some nice things there, but the story I'm trying to get to is I went fishing on Tanicomo, where I fished 40 years ago, learned a technique for catching trout with a slip sinker or slip bobber and a 84th ounce jig, and the trout just can't resist it. Mm. This time, because there were shad were coming through the dam, which is several miles up, they were coming through, and some of them were dead. You could see them floating, and the trout, rainbows and browns, are gorging on them. So we used white marabou jigs and must have caught 30... trout, and my guide, good guy, owns the marina down there. He probably caught 25 of them, but no, not really. But he did do me a little bit there. But anyway, so got my itch scratched.
Nice. I also saw a video floating around the internet of you in a cowboy hat singing some old classic country tunes. Is that your side gig now?
I'm gonna start a new career there. I'm kind of done with the hunting shows, fishing shows. Sure. You know, I've done all that. I'm going back to trying to make some big money. By the way, where I had, I'll show you a picture of a nice rainbow I caught. Interestingly, when I was in my music mode years and years ago, I wanted to be the next Andy Williams. True. And finally realized somewhere along the line, I had a nice singing voice, but I'm probably not going to be Andy Williams. I didn't want to move to New York. This trout I caught the other day.
You sang to it?
No. The guide I was with said, there's Andy Williams' house.
Oh.
So I was right in front of his mansion. Wow. Now, he's gone, of course. But the guy told me his widow still lives there. So I thought that was kind of cool.
That is a
So you go up on stage, and someone gives you a mic and says, Ron, you got to sing a song. What's the first song you sing?
Oh, I can't.
I know.
Three Blind Mice.
Cat Scratch Fever.
Mule Skinner Blues.
Yeah, Mule Skinner Blues. There you go. I made a lot of money singing a Mule Skinner Blues. Good morning, Captain. There you go.
There we go. Scott Franzen, fresh out of Montana. Anything on your road trip back that caught your eye?
There's a lot of snow geese in North Dakota. We saw more on the drive out than the way back, but several hundred thousand. It was a little dry. Hopefully they'll get some moisture here in the next week or two. Hopefully it's a good bird year too. That between Montana and the Dakotas, even Northwest Minnesota, there was snow, but not too much snow. So hopefully that's going to be good. Good for the birds coming this spring.
Right, right. Well, that's a big question mark, because if we get a little moisture in Montana, Western Dakotas, we could be looking at one of the better upland bird hunting seasons we've had in many, many, many years, because they didn't really have a winter out there, most of them. I know a few friends out in Western Dakotas that said they could mow their grass in February and January if they needed to. There was just no snow on the ground. The birds made it through okay, but obviously they're going to need a little moisture.
Right.
So we're pulling for that. But anyway, so let's get to it. The reason we're all sitting here today is because we have kind of an exciting project announcement. Scott, this is something you've wanted to do for a while, but you're wearing a very trendy-looking Flush hat, looking stylish. Oh, you've never looked
good?
That.
You
look
good. I look awesome.
You look good.
There it goes again, Ron. Yeah.
This thick. Is so sickening, Bill.
Another $20 and you get a lot of compliments. Yeah,
Ron, you and I can go golf and just leave these two to their affairs.
Travis can do no wrong. We know that now.
I'm working the system, guys. I'm working to take notes. Take notes. Anyway, and you got a nice buff on as well. So you have you've gone to work to come up with this, the hat and the buff, and it's for a purpose, right? Pheasants Forever just launched their Call of the Uplands Habitat campaign, and we are doing a little bit on our end to try to raise some money for that. So we have Flush hats, we have Flush buffs, and they are for sale now. And they're a limited supply. I think you've got 100 of them. You said you ordered 100 hats and how many buffs?
300 buffs.
300 buffs. Okay.
Yep.
Once they're gone,
edition.
Once they're gone, they're gone. They've got the Flush logo on it. Federal is a partner of this as well. So we'll have that available on our website. So there'll be a link that people can find them on. Otherwise, go to theflush.tv. You'll be able to learn more about that. But so today what we did was actually we posted a question on our Facebook page, and we asked people for questions, submit a question for this show, and we'll pick 10 questions from our listeners. And if we pick your question, you're going to get a Flush hat and a Flush beanie. But what I don't think I just finished...
Not beanie, buff.
What did I say?
You said beanie.
Dang it. All right.
You just
that's
lost.
Why, Ron, that's
Ron's
why
wearing
I need
a beanie,
you guys. But... Ron's got... So anyway, every hat and buff, there it is. Any hat and buff that we sell.
Do we have another host we could have?
All of the proceeds.
Anybody else could take over the show?
I appreciate you, Ron. You hired me. You can't undo what you did. Anyway, all the proceeds from the sale of the hats and the buffs will go to Pheasants Forever's Habitat Mission. So again, once they're gone, they're gone. We hope that you'll enjoy or you'll like them and that you'll buy them. And then we're going to give all the money to Pheasants Forever to put more habitat in the ground so that we can have more birds and places to hunt. And it's a win-win-win-win-win all the way around. So gentlemen, shall we get right to it? I've got several questions. We'll see how long it takes us to fly through the first 10. The first 10 are going to get the hats and the buffs. If we go into extra innings, we'll see. But there's some good ones on there. I think because I have a hat and a buff, I'll ask the first question. Gentlemen, who had the biggest influence on your hunting life? That's a pretty big question right there. But it'll help people understand a little bit more about each one of you. Bill?
Oh, it's simple. My grandfather. We're sitting here in the outpost. Some of those old frying pans are out of the camp. If you look over the painting on the wall, that's our family place at the Ottawa River in a logging town called Fort Collonge. You can see my Canadian flag, even the nets hanging on the wall that my grandfather built. He was a moose hunter up there, and that was the bush for him, right? Wild places, and I've got his old guns, and I still have bucket list hunts that I want to accomplish using my grandfather's guns.
When's the last time you were up there?
Oh, long time ago. Long, long, long time ago. You know, it's... You get busy with life, right?
Kids, family.
Kids, family, jobs, all kinds of stuff.
Nagging boss.
Things change.
Hard-ass boss.
I call him the big kahuna.
The big kahuna.
There's 10 for you, Bill.
BK for short.
Yeah.
But those dreams are still in there, right? I want to take his gun. I want to use his moose gun to chase a moose someday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get to it. But... For now, the memories are, you know, with us. A lot of the stuff, when you look around, see that homemade sailboat? That was grandfather's, right? Grandpa Shirk just made that stuff, just for the fun of it. So
very cool.
There you go.
Very cool. Scott, how about you?
I kind of have two, I would say, Travis. Initially, my dad was my biggest influence. He used to tell stories about hunting with my grandpa, who I didn't know as well as Bill knew his. He died when I was very young. But he had a Springer Spaniel dog called Skipper, and we used to hear stories about Skipper the Wonder Dog. Skipper could do no wrong, and my grandpa and my dad would get limits of ducks and grouse and pheasants, and so I that made me want to hunt. And I played a lot of sports growing up and didn't have a lot of time, but my dad made sure I got my gun safety, and then carved out the time to take me duck hunting and do a little pheasant hunting. But we had dogs. They weren't hunting dogs. I mean, actually, we had Springers that just didn't hunt. So that was phase one. And I'd say phase two was my brother-in-law. So my sister at that time wasn't married to my brother-in-law's name, Scott, but he had hunting dogs. And I went duck hunting with him and saw how a dog can enhance a duck hunt, and I was hooked.
Scott Bittman.
Yeah. And I knew that, yeah, you know, I wanted to have my own hunting dog. I wanted my hunting dog to go out and actually shoot a duck if I could hit one in the water. I saw how they worked with upland birds and grouse. And so those two, I would say, were the biggest influences. And when my dad stopped hunting, Scott and I did a ton of hunting in the Dakota prairies. We'd camp. We'd be out in the middle of nowhere with just our dogs and in a pop-up camper that we pulled out there. And those are some of the fondest memories I have of back then. And until now, I mean, every year you create new memories, and that's the thing. And and I've got wonderful long-term college friends that I've done a lot of hunting trips with and still do a lot of hunting trips with. But those were my biggest influences growing up.
Ron, how about you?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I grew up in northeast Iowa, which is a rugged limestone country with trout streams and just about 20 miles from the Mississippi River. My first memories of my dad and mom, and I was the firstborn, so in the fall they would go hunting walnuts, and my dad would carry a .22 and hunt squirrels at the same time. So that was my first recollection, and they reminded me later that when my dad would shoot a squirrel, I would cry because I felt bad for the squirrel. Well, later I got over that. Started squirrel hunting with my dad. When I was old enough to have my gun safety, I had a single shot .22, which I still own or still have in my house. It was my dad's gun as a boy as well. Single shot Stevens lever action .22. And I remember getting my first squirrel with him. I cherish those times with him, not only for the squirrel hunting, because we would sit by a walnut tree and early in the morning the squirrels would come across the treetops to get some walnuts, you know. But my dad was, he only had an eighth grade education, but he was a college graduate when it came to hunting. He would say, you're not going to shoot. If you see a squirrel go into a leaf nest, you're not shooting. Because if you hit him in there, he's going to die and
you're not going to get him.
You're not going to get him. And so that was the, and he didn't want me to hunt with a shotgun either for squirrels because he didn't want all those pellets in the meat and taking hair into the meat. He didn't like that either. Mm-hmm. So when I shoot him in the head, which is another rule, and as soon as they get to the ground, you clean it and skin it, get the inside out, and get it ready, no hair on it, and get it so your mom can cook it, the squirrels. So that was my first lesson. Now, when it came to bird hunting, my dad wasn't much of a bird hunter, but my mother's brothers were. And we did some walking, but their idea of shooting pheasants was you see one in the ditch, you slow down and roll the window down. So I eventually learned that wasn't the right thing to do. So I got rid of that technique. But then, like Scott, I didn't have a dog, but I got a Cocker Spaniel for, name was Taffy as a kid. And now I'm starting to try to pheasant hunt. And she was Birdie. It's the first Birdie dog I ever had was a Cocker Spaniel. And they are Birdie. No training. And it would put pheasants up 200 yards down the road ditch. But nevertheless, it was fun to have that. So that planted the seeds. And I've gone on from there. My, you know, I've got some fond, like Scott, I've got some fond memories of the time I shot all of the birds for Scott and stuff like that. So
highlights.
Another highlight.
All right. Well, we'll get right into some viewer questions here. Don Eason with our first question. So first, thank you for another great year. In season 11, episode 4 and episode 9 of The Flush, the show celebrated and honored the dogs. As big as the dogs are a part of the hunt, they're an even bigger part of our lives. What are the best breeds for upland bird hunting? We actually had a handful of different questions of people asking what are the best breeds for specific
dogs. We're going to be here a while.
Yeah. Right. Ron, do you have any preferences on the different dogs that you've had in your life? And obviously labs have been such a big part of your life. I have to think you're going to talk pretty in-depth about labs, but what's your take?
My take is, yes, I was a lab guy, but before that I was a golden retriever guy. Okay. That's my first legitimate hunting dog. Besides a Cocker Spaniel, but one that was trained was a golden retriever, and I love golden retrievers. And then, of course, went to labs. I went to labs largely because I got hooked up into the field trialing, and if you're going to get ribbons and field trialing, for the most part, it's a generalization, you need to have a lab, because goldens are great, but they're just not as flashy as a lab, and the judges will say, you know, they scored. Here's my take on what breed. I like any dog that's a good, well-trained hunting dog, whether it's a German short hair pointer, I don't care what it is. If it's a good dog, I'm with it, because I've hunted with, Brittany's. Mm-hmm. I've hunted with a lot of different breeds, and if they're a good dog, that's all I'm asking for. So I don't make judgments.
Right, and I would say, too, and from my experience and a lot of the people we've hunted with over the years, there's so many great dogs in every single breed, but if you have a disciplined dog, you know, well-trained in the discipline, the instincts of the dog take over when you're hunting, but you just have to be able to control that dog, because a hunt can go bad when you've got a guy screaming, trying to track down this dog a mile and a half away.
I was that guy with my first dog.
And
I got him in college. He was my first legit hunting dog, and he was Birdie, but he was not trained well. And he was a golden. My first dog was a golden, too. And by the time he was six, I didn't have to come out of the field horse. And I vowed that would be the last time I'd do that, so I trained all my other dogs differently after that. But here's how I would answer that question. I think it depends on how you hunt, what you hunt, and where you hunt. And I am a lab guy now because of where I live and what I hunt. And they're versatile. They can hunt any type of upland game, and obviously good waterfowl dogs, good house companions, etc. But if I lived in more quail country, I would probably have some sort of pointer and love that dog just as much as I love my labs, and because of where you are and what you're hunting. So I think that's the biggest thing to consider for anybody who's looking at getting a dog or, you know, a different type of dog, is how do you like to hunt? Where do you hunt? What's the cover like? And that sort of thing, you know, and then you can narrow down what they are. Because I agree with Ron that, I've even seen German Shepherds that are great bird dogs that, you know, grew up on a farm, and the farmer decided he was going to hunt with them, and my God, I saw German Shepherds put up birds I've never seen before. But it's a dog that is disciplined, control, but it also is in tune to how you want to hunt. Really,
I had a friend that had a collie, and he saw my labs out there, so he brought his collie out there. Well, the first time the guns went off, that dog ran back to the truck and crawled underneath it. It was scared.
Right.
And it, for years, that dog, if a sound of a gun, it was nowhere to be found. And then I don't know what happened. Suddenly, in the later years, that collie, he took him out one more time, got Birdie, the gun went off, and he went and caught and got it and became a wonderful hunting dog, a collie.
Wow, that's fascinating.
But I would add one more thing. As Scott mentioned, your lifestyle. Now, you have a pointing breed.
Yeah.
And sadly, you didn't ask me. But
I avoided you. Is what I did. If
pointing breeds tend to need more exercising, and that's what they are. They are a running dog. And if you're not in good position, if you live in downtown Minneapolis in an apartment or whatever, I don't think that's the breed for you, because you're not doing the dog any favor. And where a lab, yeah, they need exercise too, but not nearly like a pointer. They're just not built for that. So that's another consideration.
Absolutely. I can definitely speak to that. And just a few months ago, we had this stretch where Daisy had stitches that turned into getting staples, and every time, 2 weeks, can't get it wet, can't run, you know. And so here's this dog that just wants to run and sees my kids outside, and that energy that they build up. And I feel like I've learned the recipe with my dog and how to get her to hunt like just an absolute rock star. If I run her for 15 miles before I get to the property, she'll be ready to go. She'll be ready to hunt. She just gets all of that energy out. And now she's, I mean, because by the afternoon, that dog is just a rock star. But the first, when she gets out of the box in the field, she just wants to just scream back and forth.
Oh,
you know,
see,
and
that nonstop, yeah, right? Everywhere we go.
Right, yep. Right. And that's the breed. And I would say, too, my take on this question, the habitat. So my dog is amazing to watch in open space. She is, her instincts to hunt, the way she's, back and forth courting, and just, she's using the wind, and you can tell the second she picks up a scent of a bird, and then how she moves in on it, and then boom, she just locks it in, and that thing is not moving, and neither is she, which is awesome. But if you're in cattail country, now you can't see any of that.
Right.
And you don't know how far away is she, why is she running, what's going on there. So whereas a lab that's going to stay closer, that lab is working, and you're going to be able to get a bird up mostly in range. Well, she's working those cattails. She knows what's going on in front of her, but I can't see.
Will she go into the cattails?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Hunt them?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I really wondered about that.
She has just too much drive in her. Their prey drive is so strong that if I had a 20-pound ball attached to her collar, she would drag it through whatever it took to get to that bird.
Now, Travis, add some standing corn. I'll share this story with you. Years ago, I was interviewing this guy from Alabama. He just drove up to South Dakota to open the pheasant season, and he was so excited because he stopped in St. Louis to pick up his pointing dog from the trainer. And so he really wasn't familiar with the dog, but he was so excited because he had this dog trained, and he brought it to South Dakota with him. So I said to him, I said, well, that's great. I said, I'll talk to you tomorrow. We'll get a picture of you and your pheasants. He said, okay. It was great. And so the next day I go to his room, his motel room was open. He was standing there with a scotch in his hand. I go up real happy. I go, hey, how'd you do? He said, I go, what? Oh, he says, the season opens at noon. He says, I let that damn dog out at 11 o'clock this morning, and I ain't seen the damn thing since. And I don't know if he ever found that dog.
Well, I would, just to wrap this one up, I feel like the people that invest in their dog in the time, doesn't matter the breed, you're going to get the most out of the dog, what you put into it. So consider your terrain, what kind of bird you like to hunt, and the time that you're going to invest in it, you're going to end up with a good bird dog.
And one more thing, when you go to get one, some of the breeding and their history is, bloodlines is great. The biggest, most important thing to look at is what do the mother and father do? Have they been trained to hunt? Are they good hunters, etc.? Because if they're not, you have an increased odds that this puppy that you're getting will be a dodo. So, I mean, it's important to get that.
And that's a good point, too, because I've hunted with Daisy's mom and dad on multiple occasions, and each time I left the field, I was just like, gosh, if I could someday have a dog like that. There wasn't a bird on that property every time we'd walk into a field that they wouldn't lock down on just incredible points. It was impressive. So that's why when the opportunity came, I was like, I know where this dog comes from. You know, and so that's a lot of fun. All right, we'll move on here. This is a great question, probably aimed at Ron.
Sorry. Here we go.
Yes, I've always been a good shot.
Out of the decades in which you've hunted pheasants, which one was the best or most memorable? You've had the most decades to hunt them, so can you point to one?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Remember that year when they came here?
Yeah.
Was that the Dust Bowl year?
It was a little before that.
You guys want to have fun at my expense? Go right ahead. I can still remember the first pheasant I ever got with a 410 in the air. And when it fell, nobody was more surprised than maybe the pheasant.
Yeah.
So I remember that. And then things... you're right, but then I went to Iowa State University. I helped a graduate student do pheasant research, so I would be out and then some hunting. This is a tough question. When I first went to South Dakota, my luck in 1966 was one of South Dakota's so-called poorest pheasant populations, part of my job was to find some non-residents for the opener, and I found some guys from Missouri, and they started hunting at noon. It took them to 3 o'clock to get 30 birds, and they thought they were so disgusted. They thought that was so awful.
Yes.
That they had to hunt for 3 hours to get 30 birds.
Wow.
And the next day, Sunday, they got their 30 birds in an hour and a half, and they just went back to their whiskey. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a lot of, I don't know. They all kind of melt together.
Would the 70s be kind of the heydays?
In Iowa, for sure, the 70s were the heydays. Sadly for me, being a former Iowan, but, you know, I've lived in Minnesota now for half century or more, but Iowa was at one time in the 70s, maybe even the early, I'm losing here, but maybe even sometime in the 80s, had a higher pheasant population than South Dakota. And then ag practices changed. Ethanol came in, and pretty soon Iowa's pheasant population went right in the tank. And for the most part, except in maybe the northwest corner, it's still that way. And so it's a sad story. But I have fond memories of pheasants in Iowa and south of southern Iowa. Back when I was at Iowa State University, all the pheasants were in northern Iowa. And there was a graduate student wondering why they weren't in southern Iowa. And then later, the pheasants were all in southern Iowa, along with quail, and there weren't any birds in northern Iowa because it was all cornfields and soybeans.
Habitat.
It's all gone. It's all very magical. If you're ever wondering why you got birds or don't have birds, just look at the ground.
Right, right. If you've hunted more than one day in your life, you know why they're there.
Yeah, for sure.
Very simple. Scott?
I'll answer it in this way. I remember the early 90s when I think Conservation Reserve Program was at its height. And there was close to 40 million acres, I believe, in CRP. In going camping with my brother-in-law, Scott Bittman, and we would pull our little pop-up tent trailer out onto a field road in the middle of a section line and set up camp there and walk out our door. Well, actually, one morning we rolled in at 3 in the morning. At about 7 o'clock, we're still in our bunks, getting ready to go. Coffee's going, and we hear this noise outside. And we're hearing it. What is that noise? And we take our coffee out, and we step out, and there's about a dozen sharptail sitting on the heads of the sunflower seeds right where we're camping. And we could walk out on both private and public land from our doorstep and hunt 4 square miles of grass. And I remember that to a T. And we'd put little backpacks on, pack a sandwich, and just walk until we filled out and come back to our camp. And I that's what I remember, is when there was habitat and grass and access in that decade.
Bill?
Well, I look at this a little differently. than you guys, right? Every hunt is special, right? They all seem larger than life. Your next one, it's like Ron used to say in the shop, you're only as good as your next story, right? But
that's still true, Bill.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm in trouble.
What have you done for me lately?
But I look forward to the next hunt just as much as my favorite memories, right? Every little hunt has some bit of magic. Even the hunts where there aren't a lot of birds around, there's always something. One little nugget that you take away, and that's your memory, and it makes that seem like it was the best hunt, right? Even from last fall, you know, great hunts.
Last fall was a good fall.
Last fall was really, really good.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. There are birds everywhere, and not just pheasants, but mm-hmm. sharpies like rats and grouse and woodcock. I mean, mm-hmm. so I don't know, you know. Obviously, when the habitat is good on the prairie, there are more birds. And if you've been hunting long enough, you see those cycles, right? It's up, and then there are years where it's down for a while, and then it's back up. And maybe it makes you feel a little bit old because you start to see those cycles, but mm-hmm. it's also part of the game, which I find very, very interesting.
Yeah. Jared Quaid, thank you for that question. We'll move on. Let's see. Kevin Zietzma from Canada. Once this COVIDness is done, planning any more hunts north of the border? If so, what would you do? Bill, I'm going to talk to you first about this because you just talked to a friend of yours up in Canada that has a lodge up there.
Yep.
What's his take on Americans crossing the border to head up there?
Well, so to understand the border challenges right now, obviously the border between U.S. and Canada is closed for people who just want to go back and forth and travel and do their thing. And Trudeau is very clear in saying, I want to protect the people of my country. I want to protect the health of our population. So some people see that as being a little bit stubborn, right? Because business or recreation opportunities suffer as a consequence of that. But I also understand it's important to keep people safe, right? I don't know when the border's going to open, right? Nobody's got a crystal ball that can really, really clearly tell us when things are going to change. Maybe midsummer, maybe fall. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, when it opens, where would you go?
North. Right. You know, I have a love affair with Canada. Obviously, that's where I was born.
Yeah.
But the grouse woods are unbelievable up there. You know, the birds are different because so many of the birds you hunt have never seen a human.
Right.
Gosh, the prairies, you know.
Yeah, because you've hunted Saskatchewan, right? On the prairie and
it's unbelievable.
In the woods. Yeah.
Right? The oil field. Alberta, we've hunted, you know, sharpies and huns and pheasants over that way, and it's just endless.
So what would you pick then, based on, you know, rough grouse or prairie birds?
They're all fantastic, right? Why do I have to choose between one or the other?
Well,
I love the woods.
Because I'm not paying for two trips.
you're fortunate because it's your job. You get to go and experience something new each time. But let's say somebody has a once-in-a-lifetime bucket list hunt, which we get a lot of listeners that reach out and say, what would you do?
All right, so three options. Get to Calgary, hit the Brooks area, Lethbridge, that area for sharpies and huns. Because they're all over the place. And there are some pheasants there as well. That's one option. I love chasing the sharpies, and I think it's called the Turtle Mountains up there. It's just beautiful, endless.
And that's not too far across the U.S. border.
No, and folks kind of sneak north to do that. You know, Saskatchewan is an unusual landscape in that the oil fields are going and you're hunting coveys of birds that are tucked into the habitat in those areas. And their bird numbers are really, really good. But I think in Saskatchewan, U.S. citizens can't hunt pheasants. We can only hunt huns and
sharptail.
Sharptail. You can't hunt pheasants. You have to be, I think it's part of the province, not just Canada, if I'm correct. But anyhow, most folks can't hunt them from the U.S., so we go for the sharpies and the huns there. Third option would be Ontario, getting in the woods and hunt grouse, spruce grouse and ruff grouse. Woodcock, you know, are considered a migratory bird up there, so you need different licensing, where here, you know, you kind of hunt them all together, but there you have to make sure your licensing is in order to be able to hunt both those birds. But, you know, they're three very different experiences, but all profound. And the grouse in Quebec, right?
Yeah.
So.
Right. Well, Scott, you and I, we hunted together on the islands on Lake of the Woods, and I still put that hunt up there for, you know, somebody looking for a bucket list adventure kind of hunt. Mm-hmm. I put it up there pretty high because of just the variety of opportunities. So most people that like to hunt also like to fish. Well, there's not a better place in North America.
Hunt.
Yeah.
Right.
And we did waterfowl as well. Yep. One island, we never left it. We had plans to venture all over the place, but we literally didn't leave the island because we were catching walleyes right off the dock as fast as we could catch them. The backside of the island had rice, so we were able to waterfowl hunt. We shot a limited ducks is almost as fast as we could shoot them. We had to wait a little bit because the cameraman's like, dude, slow down, guys. Slow down a little bit. And then the grouse were all over the island too. So, and they're, you know, it's public land, the crown land up there. And once you have your license, you can go. And I've had a lot of people reach out, Scott, and I'm sure you've probably talked to viewers as well about this, but I think that's just one of those opportunities that if you enjoy grouse hunting in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, it's almost like it just takes it to a different level.
I agree. And you could do that that same type of hunt on Lake of the Woods, but you could do like a Lac Seul,
yeah,
the big lakes north, and that early September, mid September timeframe, the fishing is phenomenal, and then you can, you know, you add in the grouse hunting, it's a great trip. I want to do, if we were able to do it this year, I would like to do a waterfowl upland hunt in Saskatchewan. I did it many years ago and was amazed at the number of sharptail and huns we saw while going to waterfowl hunt.
Yeah, right.
And so when we were done snow goose hunting in the morning, one afternoon, rather than take a nap, we went to a public area and walked for sharptail. And I think we shot 5 sharptail in an hour and saw more, missed some. And I want to do that hunt again. And I'd love to film that. Especially for, you know, with my dog, soon to be dogs, to do that combo of waterfowl upland, I think is just a gas. So that's something that is on my bucket list if we were able to do it this fall.
I will say, if you're going to do those hunts, you have to be so careful. Regulations, transporting birds, because they are buggers at the border.
Yep, and guns.
And fish and wildlife, they're... like on both sides, they are there watching and they are checking. And it almost feels like it's a bit of a hassle at times, but you have to have your ducks in a row.
Here we go, Ron. John Simic writes, of all the upland species, what is your favorite to hunt? Is that because of the bird or the habitat in which you got to hunt that bird? And what gauge choke do you hunt that bird with?
Oh, boy. Well, again, I don't like to judge each bird because each is unique.
Mm-hmm.
For pheasants, obviously, gorgeous bird, very abundant in upper Midwest. I use a couple of chokes, not open, but improved modified or modified for the most part. I use probably number 6 shot. And nothing special there. I don't like 3-inch shells because I don't want to hurt myself as much as I do the bird. And so I stick with 2 3/4. For rough grouse, I use 7.5 or 8 shot. And again, improved cylinder. And sometimes a 20 gauge instead of 12. I like a 12 gauge for pheasant. Pheasants are a tough bird. And so... Nothing worse than the cripple one.
Agreed.
And not that you can't with a 12-gauge, but at least you're giving them as much as you can. So, but a 20-gauge is a great rough grouse. A rough grouse, they die easily is a word to
just
say.
Just got to get that one BB in there.
Yeah.
Maybe that's and, why I like hunting them.
So 7.5, 8 shot, I use 20-gauge. Quail, the same thing, a 20-gauge. Improved cylinder, again, want as big a pattern as I can get. The thing about quail, oh my, is when you're not used to hunting them much, like we don't, but we go down to Arizona and other places to do flush stories, and I'm not used to, for my eye to pick up some of these quail as they're coming off the ground, and sometimes they're the same color as the terrain, and I had a heck of a time in Arizona to pick them out, and besides that, they were tough to find in the first place, mm-hmm. and every plant down there hated me. I noticed that too. in fact, I pulled out parts of them for a year afterwards. But anyway,
most people walk around those plants. But anyway,
oh, really?
Yeah,
really. I did. Now you tell me. So that's kind of sums it up there.
Yeah, Scott, you have a favorite bird?
Whatever I am chasing at the time behind my dog.
Yeah, but let's say you've got to go on a hunt. It's your hunt. You're not filming. You just get to go.
Oh, then I would just probably say pheasants because that's what we're closest to here. I'd probably say pheasants. I don't know. I've grown very fond of quail, even though I haven't hunted them that much. I just think it's such a rush when they get up and you're not expecting that mm-hmm. to get up, that when you're expecting a big rooster to get up and it's the bumblebees, it mm-hmm. scares the crap out of me. And I usually miss way more than I hit them, but I think they're really a fun bird to hunt. But I've hunted this year a couple species I hadn't hunted before, blue grouse, sage grouse. And I did it with, you know, Hank, and I would do that again too. It's a different challenge for every bird. So if I had to choose one, I would choose pheasants because that's here and I can do that within an hour and a half or 2 hours of my house. But if I was going to do an extended trip, it could be any variety of dog. And on the gun thing, I would answer it this way. I have grown very fond of my 20 gauge. And I've, knocked down a lot of birds at distances that I think people would be surprised at. And it's not because I'm a good shot, as you guys can all attest to.
Amen. Yeah, for sure.
I just like that little gun and it's a little lighter and I might be a little quicker with it. I still use my 12 gauge almost as much, but I shoot an improved cylinder out of both those guns all year long. I don't change my choke.
What size shot do you use on your 20 gauge?
I use 5 on my 20 gauge. If I'm shooting with steel, I use 3s, and I use 3-inch on the steel, and I will vacillate between 2 3/4 and 3-inch on the 20.
So I put a lot of hours in the field this year with the new 16 gauge, that Franke 16, because I feel like there's a lot of times where, because I love shooting my 20 gauge. I love, it's a light gun over under. It's just fits well. And I feel like I'm a pretty good shot with that gun. I really like it. So the 16 is very similar to that, but it gives me that, you know, if I was wondering, should I do the 12? Because like Ron said, I hate it. If I shoot a bird and I don't find, I want it to go down,
yep.
And I don't want it to run. So, but I feel like that 16 has given me kind of that perfect mix, you know. And so
it's a light. It's a light gun.
It's so light. It fits so nice. I love shooting it.
You have to have your shells ahead of time because a lot of country shops don't carry 16.
16s, especially this year, it's tough to find. But you know, in areas, you know, when we were in Montana, you didn't know if you were going to flush a Hungarian partridge, a sharp-tailed grouse, or a pheasant. So I just felt like that was a really good all-around upland gauge. And I just fell in love with that gun this year. But I think, you know, for my lifetime of hunting, if you spend time shooting with your gun, you're going to get comfortable with one, right. and you just seem to gravitate towards the one that you're most comfortable with. Because right. so often as a shooter, it gets in your head. You yes. miss it, and you're like, what was I doing? And now you're walking, thinking about it. The next one gets up, you overcompensate, you start thinking it again, and now it's just a complete mental game.
It's kind of like golf clubs.
Yeah.
You know what your 150 club is or whatever it is.
Yeah exactly. So let's move forward here. Wesley Bickler. Which flush episode was the most difficult to film to get accurate footage to show what the actual boots on the ground experience was like? Bill.
My hand is raised.
Yeah.
This is an easy one for me. Hell's Canyon.
Yeah.
Director of photography, Aaron Ochtenberg, and I went into Hell's Canyon. Snake and Salmon Rivers there kind of come together, and we'd go by boat. And you just look off. It's all BLM. It's all public land. So you'd look off to the left and say, oh, this is a good spot. You'd pull the boat up. You'd hop out. And you'd go up 2,000 feet up that shale rock. We were chasing Huns, which the Huns were fun because they were right kind of at river level. But the chuckers, wild chuckers, real chuckers, they were 2,000 feet up. Side hilling on shale. Hot, you know, some of those plants Ron talked about that tend to stick you a little bit. I actually went through a pair of Red Wing boots in one day.
Whoa.
On that hunt.
Whoa.
One day. Walking that river. But
that's weird because you were posting most of the time too.
They just took me by parachute up to the top. You know, it was an extreme hunt.
Yeah.
Now, Aaron. He's carrying a 15-pound camera.
Right.
With
and
a backpack.
5-pound batteries.
With batteries, yeah. Right? So that was one where we had to be just a little bit tenacious. The payoff was amazing at the top. The views where you could see halfway around the world. And I'll never forget, there was a plane flying the river. And the plane was down below us.
That's I remember how, that shot.
That's yeah. how far up we had traveled to get to those birds.
Would you do it again?
Yeah, you absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. My buddy out there who we hunted with said, you know, I only hunt with, or I always hang, I only hang with people who hunt chuckers. Real chuckers, right? Everyone's hunted chuckers, but nobody's really hunted, right? A lot of preserves have them because they're an easy bird to raise, but wild chuckers are unbelievable to chase. You earn every single bird, and like we talked earlier, your memories that come out of those hunts, my God, after 6-7 hours of hiking to get back to that ice cold river, drop the boots, drop the socks, roll up the pants, and just stand knee deep in water and having a cold beer, thinking about what we had just done.
Sounds like a young man's game.
I'm out.
Yeah, I've got a similar chucker hunt experience as well. I've hunted chucker in a few different places, but the last chucker hunt that I was on was in Nevada, and it was in January, and the conditions were they had snow, which pushed the birds into a specific area, which makes hunting them a little bit easier.
Yep.
However, it warmed up. Snow melted. Some birds were on the bottom. Some birds were on the very top. Some were in the middle. You didn't know where you were going to find them. So the miles we had to put on. And then a blizzard came in. And I specifically remember the last day we went to this spot just trying to get there. There was a trail. And the guy that we were with, Matt Harding, he's like, we can get my truck to a certain point. And I remember being in the truck trying to go up to this certain point. And then we had a couple thousand feet to go. But this was the last day. And our cameraman, his feet were so blistered up
yeah.
that we actually wrapped his feet before he put his boots on. And then he stuck of it. And I felt so bad for him.
Gosh.
So bad. But he's like, no, I'm committed to getting it. And then, so we go up there. And the clouds roll in. And now you can't see much because the dogs are doing their thing. But we were in the clouds and everything you couldn't see down, so birds you could hear, you know, and oh, there they go, and had to get him close, and now the snow moves in, and so we had to be within about 20 yards because you couldn't, there was no visibility with that heavy of snow. It was like 3 inches in an hour. I mean, that's how heavy it was coming down. But I'll never forget that kind of a hunt.
Right.
You know, I mean, those are the, I think I would say all of, I've got a handful of other ones that were very difficult just because of the getting to the location. But, you know, if you're up in the mountains in some of those conditions, mainly just for our cameraman, because like you said, Bill, all of the equipment that they're carrying and to be, you know, a few feet behind us. Ron, anything stand out to you?
Oh my, yes. I mentioned the vegetation that hated me. So this just was a couple years ago. I did a hunt in Arizona for quail. A couple things there. One is, you know, if you go to I've hunted pheasants enough, I can look at the terrain and the landscape and say, if there's pheasants here, I think they'd be over here, over here. Same with rough grouse. I've hunted rough grouse enough to kind of identify habitats that they might be in. But the quail in Arizona, that was not the case. There were miles and miles of brush that where the quail, I had two Arizona quail experts with me, so I wasn't just on my own. And so what I'm trying to say is miles and miles of brush, and the quail could be anywhere, anywhere. And so you walk your tail off, and let me tell you, the vegetation, you can say what you want, it's very mean, and I had, even through my leather boots, I had cactus thorns come right into my toe. We filmed it. I had to take my boots off, and there it was in the toe. I mean, this is a lot of fun, right? So then when you're never ready, when you finally do flush one, you can't see the dogs, all of these things. Mm-hmm. Would I do it again? Absolutely not.
Meanwhile, I just booked my third Arizona quail. Can't wait to go back.
Have fun.
Oh, Scott, any hunts that stand out to you?
Well, I would answer this two ways, in that for our cameramen, I think the hardest thing for them to gather, because I saw that question as well, and I was wondering if they're talking about from a filming perspective. I think anything where there's elevation is exceedingly difficult, not only in the hunters, but double so for them, based on all the reasons you described, in filming grouse hunts. Grouse hunts in the woods are brutal because they're looking through a lens as they're trying to walk through brush, bush, everything else, and get the flush and get, you know, maybe a kill shot or the dog on point. And
even just to see the bird.
Yes.
I mean, how many times as a grouse hunter do you hear the bird and you're like,
yeah, where is it?
Where's it? And imagine carrying that camera and having to, you know, because they've got headphones on too, so they can hear the audio of the people talking and make sure that that's coming through for, you know, like worrying about all of that stuff. And then to capture the grouse, right?
And you think about when we did that, you mentioned the show we did up on Lake of the Woods, and we're bushwhacking for that grouse hunt every time. And how many times did Ben or Eric get knocked on their butt because a branch flung back into them, or then it started raining and camera. So those, in terms of showing the viewer the real thing, I think is the hardest for us to do. But they're the most rewarding when we do them, and we are able to, for the most part, depict a bush hunt for grouse, you know, or an elevation hunt for chucker. This year we did it. I did it with sage grouse and blue grouse, and in what you get, hopefully the camera sees is. What the hunter sees is not just the birds, but the scenery too in these areas as well.
And I would say that is maybe why I'm a little short with viewers at times when they send a harsh little remark that says, oh, that bird is obviously Penray. Oh, they're faking it. That bird obviously, no.
Yeah.
We hunt wild birds, and our photojournalists absolutely earn every shot, and they will be praised for that, right?
Yep.
Don't accuse us of faking it, because we work really, really hard, you know, to document these hunts.
Well, and I think some of our viewers might be surprised to know that the shows they watch are almost exclusively shot by one person. We have one camera in the field, and we have one photojournalist that has a camera, has a drone, has a GoPro, is doing all the mic work and things like that. So,
and that's the fun of it.
Yeah, right? Once in a while, there'll be multiple, but for the most
part, it's one person.
We're working together with them. Yeah,
I never get more than one.
You don't?
Well, yeah, me either.
It's usually
me neither, Trav. I think maybe.
Wait a minute! You had two in Montana last fall.
I have another segment idea.
Yeah, Aaron and Troy, come on.
One and a half.
Sure.
I have another segment idea, Travis.
Sure.
For you and Bill, a woodcock eating contest. That's what I'd like to see.
Bill's up to 67.
Moving right along. What was the... Oh, this one's for me. Bill Knapp asked, what was the moment like when Daisy turned from crazy running pup to actual bird dog? What part of your training made the difference? So I think I could look back to... I took her on several hunts last year, learned a ton on my own, but that dog did as well. And I think on a hunt in South Dakota in December, she had been out in the field quite a few times. And this particular hunt, we were on properties that had thousands of birds, wild birds, and the repetition, the chances she had, she came into contact with hundreds of birds throughout the day. And by the second day of a 6-day hunt, that dog, I mean, she was locking on points, and she's like, all right, let's do this, because it reinforced that I'm out there with her together, so she didn't have to go hunt on her own. We were hunting together, and what part of that made the biggest difference? I think really there's no substitute for putting your dog, your puppy, on wild birds and giving them the opportunity to make mistakes and to learn and to repeat. She grew a year in those 5 days. And now this spring, I've taken her out locally here, just on walks. I mean, that dog is, from when I picked her up at 6 months old and took her on the first hunt where she ran all the way across the Badlands of North Dakota to where I let her out of the truck and she went 60 yards and locked a bird down 6 inches from her nose and didn't move it until I walked up and did 20 of those in a row, listening to every command I gave. It was just working with her nonstop on obedience, letting her instincts take over, but focusing on her obedience, staying with me. And now that dog, I cannot wait to hunt with her this fall. I can't wait for you guys to hunt with her this fall to see the work that we've put in. But first, I'm just going to look like such a dumbass on national television when that first show airs. I almost don't even want to air it because that puppy did not belong out there, and I put her out there.
Well, I was going to tell you, you belong to call yourself a dumbass on that one. I would add this, though. Travis, you know, you can say all you want about introducing your dog with wild birds. I would disagree with that. I would start my dog on pen-raised birds at a shooting preserve. You're guaranteed to get into a lot of them, and you have a controlled situation there. You can even just put some birds out so you know where they're at and direct your dog to them in different ways. So, I mean, it's fine and dandy, but, you know, you're at an advantage over a lot of people about going to places full of wild birds.
Yeah.
They don't have that. So that's a great use of shooting preserves, by the way.
Right. Yep. I know that, you know, I've talked about it on this show quite a bit, the experiences with her, and I've had a lot of trainers send me information, a lot of people, and there's a lot of ways to go. I think the biggest thing for me is that I took the initiative. I mean, I obviously had some very good advice from, you know, my friend George Lyle, who's trained dogs his whole life. I mean, his dogs are phenomenal. I trust him. Other people that I trust, too, giving me advice. And then just sticking with it and learning. And since then, I've now been able to see what that training is like. Go from a wild puppy to this dog that now, sure, she's still a pup and she'll have her learning curves. But to where she is today, it's pretty remarkable. And now people ask, would you do it again? I'd say, heck yeah, because I invested my time in this dog, and then I've been able to learn from it together, which I think is going to help me for the rest of my hunting career versus just handing it over to a trainer and then getting that dog back and not really knowing what it took to get that dog to learn those commands and hunt with me and stuff. So you know, it's the journey, right? I think that's going to make the hunts a lot sweeter. And I've, all these years, I've heard everybody that I've interviewed all over the country, everyone says the same thing. It's about the dogs.
Yep.
It's all about the dogs. I do it for the dogs. And here I've got this wild puppy running wild. I'm like, you know what, guys? This is not fun. Yeah. It's not about the dogs because it's ruining this experience. But I'm sure this year I'll say, boy, it's about the dogs.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So anyway, good question, Bill. Let's see. Let's go with Julia Schrenkler. I'd love to hear you talking about taking kids out hunting. Memories, stories, advice are all welcome. Scott, you've got a lot of experience with that. Ron, you've got experience with that. Bill, your boys are getting ready. You guys are getting ready to go turkey hunting, as a matter of fact. I've got kids. I've got my own stories, too. Does anybody want to share a favorite story or have any advice for parents taking kids out hunting?
Short and sweet.
Yeah, make it fun. Don't make it a death march. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, even if you start at a preserve, that's another way to introduce them to it. I have a favorite story about my youngest, Hannah, when I was training our dog Izzy, who we just did the show on this year, and I was taking Izzy to a game farm to put out six birds prior to her first big hunt. We'd done it several times. This is kind of her last tune up, and Hannah was 6 years old, and we're hunting these birds, and the first one gets up, and boom, I miss. And I'm like, good girl, Iz, good job. And next bird gets up, and boom, I miss again. Dog's doing fine. Hannah's kind of giving me a cross-eyed look. And the third bird gets up, I miss again. And she stops, stares at me, puts her hands on her hip, says, Dad, Izzy's on fire, and you keep missing. Knock it off. And so from then on, I hit every bird. I just need a little scolding from my daughter.
Wow.
But it's those experiences, I think. So for me, it was that made Hannah want to go out and chase wild birds because she thought it was going to be similar. And it wasn't, but she was okay with that. She was a little bit older. And she and as well as Grace and Maddie, my other two daughters, just love seeing the dogs do their thing. And there is for us, or for those of you who own dogs, I'm sure you've seen it, that the dog you have at home and in your house or wherever you have it is a different dog in the field. So that's what we did. And we, to Bill's point, take it easy. Don't bring your 6-year-old kid on a 10-mile walk for birds the first time out.
The Shirk boys do very little pheasant hunting because even now they're 10 and 12. That habitat that is knee-deep or waist-deep for us is up over their necks, over their heads, right? Mm-hmm. It is very difficult. So we'll do preserve hunts, you know, put out 12 birds for an hour and go out and just have a heyday. And the boys get to carry a bird in their packs, right? And then we celebrate with ice cream and keep them wanting more.
Candy. We were
always
a lot of candy.
Yes.
Snacks.
Yeah.
A lot
right?
of snacks.
And that sounds, you know, maybe like it's silly advice, but they create positive memories based on those experiences, and that makes them want more. And as they grow, they will naturally get more into the guns and become comfortable with the kick and all that stuff, but they look forward to it. My oldest now asks, hey, Dad, are we going pheasant hunting? So you know what's in there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't push it on them. Let them ask you, right?
Yep.
That's great advice, Bill. Really great advice. My daughters are both adult women now, but when they were young, 8 to 12 years old, they'd walk behind me in South Dakota and carry the pheasants, you know, and look at them. And one time they sent, they wanted to show and tell at schools.
Yep.
So I had cleaned a pheasant at home, so we put the head in a box and the tail, and they took it to school. I'm not sure the teacher was excited about that. But they came back crying because some of their fellow students were saying that was awful, that your dad killed this bird. So that was their first experience with animal rights, so to speak, or just kids that don't understand that. But your advice about And I did this not all the time wisely, but bringing a little lunch along while you're pheasant hunting, make it something more than just hunting. And that's great advice. I wish I'd have done that with my oldest daughter on her first canoe trip to Boundary Waters, because I had a guide and he just bit off, I guess because he thought I was going to, you know, I was writing about it. I needed this grand adventure, and it was way too long.
Yeah.
And so Simone got, she did not have a good time, and she won't even look at the Boundary Waters now. So I go, wised up. So daughter Laura, the younger, I took her, we just went on one portage, but then it rained all the time. And so she didn't want to go back either. So
I'd add this one thing to what Ron said too, and my girls were young too. I let them, if they're curious, I let them do whatever they want, and I didn't force it. And so they got used to handling birds, dead birds, and they didn't mind that. They watched me clean them. I, too, let Hannah, in this case, bring in a foot and a crop and something else, and the crop was full of corn, and I explained what it was there for, and she talked about it for show and tell, and actually she didn't get any pushback on it. She said my teacher looked at me a little funny, but but she wanted to bring it in. So it was also part of a learning lesson too, and a little bit of biology and things like that for the kids too.
Yeah. And by the way, both of my daughters now are avid pheasant hunters.
Right,
so there
right,
you go.
Right. There you go. Yeah, I think just bringing them along on the experience, I've learned that to celebrate moments that happen in the field. If that bird gets up, say, "You guys, we got that close." I mean, my kids are young, so they're wowed by these things. But Bill, I relate. My kids' legs are a lot shorter than mine yet, and that grass doesn't work. But we went on a grouse hunt this fall. They can walk through the woods.
Yep.
And I specifically remember we got into a bunch of grouse, and my little boy, he was 4 at the time, "Dad, his little raspy, "Dad, there's a grouse in front of me." And it was standing like 3 feet in front of him. And then it went and flush in there. It was just like the coolest experience for him. And then we got a couple of birds and we quit. After the big, we end on a high. I've learned long ago with kids, in my experience, taking kids fishing and all that, any outdoor experience, end on a high because you leave them wanting more.
Want them more.
Yep. And they want to go back in. Let's move on. If you could impart one piece of wisdom to someone training a bird dog for the first time, what would it be? I'll go first. Do not train your dog when you have emotion, when you are frustrated. You want to train when you can put your emotions to the side and just be there for the dog to work with them and through any challenges that they're facing. If frustrations come in, it doesn't help the training experience. So only train when you are not, when you are able to remove emotion from the equation.
I agree with that 100%, Travis, and I would add, manage your expectations.
Yeah.
That, whether it's at what phase of the training you may be in with the dog, but also your first hunt. And Ron's example of the man from Alabama who just got his hunting dog, was expecting this great hunt, and his dog left him, basically. But, you know, when for you, Trav, you mentioned Daisy.
Yeah.
In your first hunt, you probably had high expectations going out there, and she cruised, and you just got to manage your expectations of the dog, because first it's a dog, and B, it's, you know, if they're young, they're like a young kid at that point, and they will respond to you if you put the time into it and in the right frame of mind.
Yeah, plus two, you know, a puppy, how quick they age and how much they learn from 6 months to even what I'm seeing in a year. And I assume it's going to continue, just their understanding and their obedience and just their maybe chill.
Yeah.
Maybe chill for some breeds. You know, that's going to change. Ron, you've had a lot of dogs in your years. Anything that you'd recommend?
Yeah, and none of which you've mentioned yet. Learn how a dog learns. Because if you don't understand that, you're not going to, you know, you can say heel 1 minute and sit down the next or whatever. They don't get it unless you're consistent. So get a good book, read about how to train a dog, maybe have a friend who already has done some training, and that push come to shove, take your dog to a professional trainer. Sometimes they'll do it together with you and the dog. Mm-hmm. I've trained dogs when I was in college. And let me tell you, the worst part of training a dog was training the owner.
Right.
Because I'd have the dog all ready to go healing. I say, take the dog healing now. And the next thing you know, he's telling it to here, here, here. He's not using the commands the dog knew. So very frustrating. So that would be my learn how a dog learns, because if you don't, you're not going to have much progress.
I've talked to a lot of trainers, and they say that a lot of the struggles in getting a dog to do what people want it to do is that the owner doesn't pay attention to what they are trying to teach and doesn't continue that. So a lot of it is they need to train the owner. If you're not going to invest the time to understand what that dog needs, your dog won't reach its full potential, really. So a lot of it is maybe a good piece of advice would be if you take your dog somewhere to be trained, really try to get that trainer to teach you what you need to do to help that dog.
Well, one more thing, Travis, and that is, and we could talk all day about this, but I gave seminars at the state fair for 15 years telling, especially women, a dog respects a lower voice for the higher voice, and women especially like to ask their dog to do stuff. You don't ask your dog to do things. A dog is a pack animal, and the leader of the pack does not ask the dog to do something. It growls and gets in its face. So that doesn't mean you have to be mean, but that means you don't say, come here. You say, here, or come. You say it, lower your voice, and say like you mean it, because they, as a pack animal, that's what they respect.
Well put.
Ron. Here.
I'm coming, Buana.
I had flashbacks from my early
Travis
days.
Coming to my office.
I know. My first couple of years at the company, I tucked my tail in. Yes, Ron. All right, guys. I think we're close here to wrapping this up, but what is a hunt or place in the U.S. where you can't wait to hunt for the first time?
Well, I was going to say Arizona and New Mexico, but...
You go, Bill. I'll stay home.
All right. It's easy for me. I've been all over the country. Every destination is amazing. I have never hunted the Northeast.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, Bill, we need to send you to
the classic camps of Vermont
and Maine. Yep.
Right? The stories that come out of there. I want to experience that at some point.
Mm-hmm.
The end.
There you go. Scott.
I want to do Bill's checker hunt. I want to do that hunt. I want to do it while I can get up and down that mountain still. Yes. I want to experience wild chuckers and just kind of driving down a river and saying, this looks like a good spot to hunt. I'm pull over and let's go. I want to do that one.
Scott, or Ron.
Wow. I've been everywhere.
There we go.
I don't know. I really enjoyed going down to Georgia and doing quail hunting the way they used to at the turn of the century or whatever. That was joyful. I would maybe go to Mississippi or Louisiana and see that again. Also enjoyed quail hunting in Texas. Hunted there with a kid that started the first Texas Quail Unlimited chapter. And he was an amazing young man. He was a sophomore or junior in high school when I met him. And I'll never forget, I told somebody, I think I just met a future president of the United States. And that still might be true, but that's a good question. Not hunted Florida for quail. I hunted Florida for wild turkey. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe a shooting preserve just down the block from my house.
I would go ptarmigan in Alaska, because I've been to Alaska once, and just being in a place like that, so massive, so incredible, and being able to watch a dog do its thing. I can't think of a better place. And if I can't go to Alaska, I would say ptarmigan in Colorado, because we have them here as well. So last question, guys. And this one here is maybe a little bit tough to... answer, but I take pride, or let's see, Joe is his name, Sue Archer 22 on Instagram. I take pride in being a respectful outdoorsman and be a steward of the land, be it public or private, but we all know stories of bad apples spoiling the whole bunch. In your experience, what's the best way to deal with people who don't want hunters anywhere near them or their land?
Well, it's their land. You don't argue. When I was in Nebraska this year, I went in, no, South Dakota. Hell, I don't remember. It was South Dakota. I stopped. I saw a place that looked pheasant-y to me. It was private land, so I pulled into the farmer's place and went up, knocked on the door. The guy said, I just saw your place. I'm wondering if I could do a little hunting. He said, my son is coming this weekend. I'm holding it for him. So, no problem. So I think, you know, being respectful. The other thing I've learned that farmers like to talk about what's going on, too. And so I like to talk to them about, if it gets that far, about what they're farming and what's going on, how's the corn crop or whatever, so they get to know you a little bit. And if you get no, don't go pouting away and calling him a SOB or whatever. I mean, really, right. Just be right. Respectful.
Well, I think this question here kind of almost points to, if you come across somebody while in the field, maybe on public land, that they're being a jerk. Because I think that scenario plays out pretty regularly. When you show up to a property, somebody else is there, they try to bully you away from the hunting area because they want it. Or, you know, sometimes that clash happens on public grounds. You know, and I feel like I've seen it happen several times. I hunt a lot of public land. I've seen it happen in South Dakota and other places where you're walking and you're like, what are these guys doing? They clearly see us, and yet they're not being respectful. And I think, you know, having a conversation with them about it, but even if they choose to be disrespectful, hopefully you're choosing to be respectful and setting a good example. Other people in the group that you're with will see it. Other people in their group will see it. It might say, wow, there might be four people and one jerk in their group. And if you have a respectful conversation with them, the other three people at least are going to leave knowing that this is probably how I want this scenario to go next time. I want it to be more like this guy, not like my jerk buddy that I'm with. And that might actually cause them to have a conversation later on. Maybe it's a dad and his son in a separate vehicle and they drive away and say, you know what, guys, when we approach those other hunters, I think we maybe want to take their approach next time. So regardless of how somebody's treating me in the field, I'm going to treat them the way that I would want to be treated, in hopes that for future, it creates a better scenario for the next time that hunter comes across somebody, because I can't change him in or her in the field, their attitude, their position on it. But I choose that versus just turning around and walking away. That's my take on it.
The world is a funny place right now, right? Opinions are not opinions these days, you know? If they're your own, they feel like they are the Bible, right? So, yes, you have to have a tremendous amount of patience.
Yeah.
You have to have an open mind, and you just have to see your glasses being half full, because people just get angry with people these days. We saw it on one of our hunts last fall. Guys who pulled up to a spot 10 minutes after we were in, and they clearly thought they were going to hunt it. And we watched those trucks drive around and go kitty corner down to the other side, and they got out and they booked in, you know, to beat us at our own game. And you just have to have a bit of grace, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
smile and appreciate what you're doing and where you are and see the positives.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. You just hope that if you choose to treat people well, that it's going to affect, somehow it's going to affect that situation differently down the road.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I feel about it.
And if that doesn't work, just let the dogs go.
Well, we have 10 questions. There's about 15 more, guys. We could spend hours going through this and telling
next
more
week
stories. I feel like we should do this again. It's always fun to catch up with you guys. The conversations are a lot of fun. But Scott, I want to bring this background, because we're going to give Flush Hat and Buff to each one of these listeners that wrote in questions for us. Scott, why did you personally, this is your mission to say, I'm going to go and I'm going to make these hats and I want to sell them. I want to keep doing more to help Pheasants Forever's mission.
Yes. I mean, that's really it, Travis. And I think the other reason is we've seen it at Pheasant Fest. We've seen it with people we've hunted with in the field. They've asked us, do you have any flush merchandise? I love the show. Are you selling anything? And we've never done that before. And we have talked about it amongst us and thought, why not try it, A, and see if some of the people that are big followers of the show may want to buy a hat or a buff. Personally, I love wearing buffs in the field. You'll probably see it on the show. I like them because in the morning, in particular when it's cold, I can just put that over my ears, and then you roll it down when it warms up. And it, anyway, so we thought, why not try it? And then we'd partner with Pheasants Forever. They've got the big mission right now, call the Uplands. We wanted to be a part of it and see if we could work with them. COVID affected all of the conservation organizations last year, and this is a small little way that we can partner with them and give something back to a partner that is very good to us, and we enjoy all of our relationships there. And so it's a trial balloon. We'll see how it goes, and if it goes well, we'll have flush long johns next year for the field.
Well, the buffs are sweet, and the hats are even sweeter.
Yeah, what's your sale price on these bad boys?
The buffs are $10, and I think the hats are $20, I believe. Is that right, Anna? $25, my bad. There $25.
There we go. Well, see,
already wholesaling them.
Yep. So they're really nice looking hats. They're sharp. I've got mine on right now, very comfortable as well.
At least on you and Scott.
Yeah. This looks very grr on us, Travis.
Right, sure. Any closing thoughts, gentlemen? As long as we've got you wrangled there, I know Ron's got a tea time shortly, so we got to wrap this up.
He's got a lunch date.
Yeah.
Well, Bill.
Oh, that's right. Bill's buying.
Bill's buying lunch.
Just wait till you get to the bill for rent.
All right. Well, no more wisdom anyway, so we'll wrap this up. Once again today, thank you to Federal Premium Ammunition and Onyx for helping us to make this show possible. Be sure to download the Onyx Hunt app before your next hunting adventure to find out why it's one of the most valuable hunting tools available today. All of the episodes of The Flush television show are up on our YouTube channel. Simply search The Flush TV on YouTube and you'll find all the shows in their entirety, and please subscribe to the channel so you don't miss any of the upcoming videos that we plan to post. You can stream each episode in its entirety from home, your bird camp, or like the big kahuna Scott Franzen likes to do while he's sitting at his desk, supposedly working.
Napping.
Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Flush Podcast. I'm Travis Frank, reminding you to take the time to introduce someone new to the field.